と、
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Today, the Light Factory opens an exhibit of the works of photographer Ansel Adams and some of the members of a group out of which his work grew. They were known as Group F64, and collectively, they redefined photography beginning in the 1930s and set the stage for its acceptance as an art form. We'll explore that later in the program. First, some musical legends. Is that a lost? So much for rehearsal. Is that a lost Beatles song rediscovered and recently released on the new digitally remastered Beatles CD? No, it is the music of another legendary group, a local group, the Sponge Tones. There are few bands in Charlotte who have been together for 30 years. There are a few such groups in the world, but the Sponge Tones have been at it for 3 decades and show no signs of stopping. Earlier this year, they released their latest CD, Scrambled Eggs. Every turn that I made, every chance that I fumbled away, every price that I paid, want this minute with you today. Well, now the Sponge Tones are taking their well-honed repertoire to, of all places, Japan. But before they go, they're here in our Spirit Square studio, and they would be Jamie Hoover, Steve Stokel, Rob Thorne, and Pat Walters. Welcome, guys.
Hi. Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Nice to have you with us. That's a great song, by the way. I wish I'd played more of it. Did you write that?
Steve Stokel and me.
And you, Pat Walters. Yeah. That's a great song.
Thank you so much.
I mean, really, I only had 3 CDs to work with. That's all I was given. But it was hard to pick because they're all just very cool songs. How do you do it? This is all a one-shot deal. I could get it. But you've been doing this for 30 years. This is the 12th album, right?
It's not hard for us to write. We really enjoy it. And it's just kind of like falling off a log, really. I mean, it's a recreation thing almost. It's almost like doing a jigsaw or something. Yeah.
How do you explain your longevity? I mean, and not only in terms of popularity, but in the fact that you're still speaking to each other.
We've had a good 4-way marriage, you know. We love each other. It's as simple as that. We're friends, you know, on and off stage, and we like doing things together.
How'd you meet?
Pat and I went to junior high together. A long time ago, and Rob was playing in bands around the area, and that's as far as how the band got together. After we'd been playing professionally for a while, Pat called me and said, "We're putting a Beatles band together," and your name came up, and Rob and Pat and Jake Berger and myself, that were the first incarnation of that band, so that's how all 4 of us got together, although Jamie came about a year later.
And there's been one extra guy who came in temporarily, but the 4 of you are the originals and have been doing
we're the guys.
Uh-huh. Ever since. Mm-hmm. Right. Started in 1981?
Actually, we count 79.
Okay.
Officially is when we really started. We had a one-off gig in 1978 and said, let's learn a bunch of 60s stuff. Nobody was doing it. And, hey, this will be a blast. And then that was it. And then a year and a half later, we thought, you know, let's get together. And it was just, we would get together every week and practice because we had other gigs that we were doing and jobs and so on. But, it was great just getting together and learning the songs and dissecting. And it was like, wow, I grew up with this stuff, but I really hadn't thought about the, you know, harmonies to a certain Beatles song or chords or whatever. And then it started coming together and let's go out and play it for the people and see what happens.
Does everybody sing?
Everybody but Rob. Actually, Rob has sung once, I recall.
Yeah, he can sing.
He can sing.
He can carry a tune.
The reason I asked is because Rob is the drummer. And Rob's the only one who hasn't spoken yet this morning.
That's because I'm a mute.
Well, these you have a very talented one.
Yeah, we've got a hand behind his back making his mouth move.
He may have a totally different story about everything.
Yes.
It's hard to get a word in.
So 1979, 81, in that time frame is when you all got together and became this band. Were you always the Sponge Tones, or did you have different names?
No, it was
the Sponge Tones.
Take us back. Who was popular then in 1979, 80, 81? Who were the hot bands? Who were the hot groups? What kind of music was popular back then among people who would come and see you play, and here you walk out and you're playing Beatles songs?
It was more, I mean, a lot of, you know, stuff going on then was sort of punk. And with our name, too, a lot of people thought we were a punk band because there was, you know, the Flesh Tones and all those other sort of tones bands. But the energy of what we were doing, too, was not unlike punk because we were, you know, I mean, I was 23 when this band started out, you know. So
I mean, the math.
We were. Yeah. Well, I know. I'm still alive and kicking. Yeah. But, you know, the energy was very much the same. But people, you didn't hear this kind of music on the radio or anywhere. We just wanted to hear it being played aloud and with the right energy. Why, like the Cavern Club. You know.
Why the Cavern. Isn't that where the Beatles started?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Why the name, Sponge Tones?
The hardest. Well, you know, it was just kind of, we mentioned our friend Jake Berger, and I think it just kind of, he just said, we're going to use the name the Sponge Tones, and it stuck, so we've kept it.
Yeah, it's actually from the years. Greek. It's the Spongetanus, is the Greek god.
Yeah, we could make up stories about how we thought about it, but
I mean, it makes sense with, you know, with how our original music, you know, we certainly have soaked up the sound of the 60s, and we used that line a number of times, but we didn't really think about it that much.
We thought we would be playing one night, so we chose a silly name. That's basically
You write in the liner notes to the album Clever, Too Clever by Half, which came out last year, that the band was supposed to last one fun night, not your musical lifetimes. So my first question was going to be, so what happened? But then the other question might be, is that tinged with regret?
No.
No, not at all.
No.
It was it's a lot of luck involved here. We chose well the first time, and it has lasted, and it was something we're extremely proud of. That's the core of what we do musically.
Well, you should be proud of it. My God, 30 years for a band to be together, unless you're just determined, in spite of your ineptitude, to keep going. But I mean, but it's not just that. I mean, the fans want to hear from you. Mm-hmm. I mean, 11 albums, it's 12 albums, right? Mm-hmm. That's a lot of albums.
We're impressed with it, you know.
You should be,
and more to come.
And you've stuck with this this Beatles sound-alike thing to a certain degree. I mean, you do branch out on certain tunes, but your latest CD, Scrambled Eggs, has several songs that are very Beatles-esque or Beatles-esque, like this one.
Some say that you just can't do it. You tell them they're wrong. Just learn to ignore their visions. Let your heart make all decisions. And it's easy to avoid collision. You'll pick that up for a song.
So who wrote this one?
Jamie and myself, Steve and Jamie. Yeah.
Okay. It's kind of a Mersey sound.
Like that. Yes, it is.
It doesn't have to be Beatles. It could be any of those groups that came
from. Chad, Jeremy, Peter, and Gordon. And I got to say, Mike, that we don't necessarily try usually to sound like a band. We just write, and what comes out. But we were thinking Chad and Jeremy.
Yeah, I mean, we've been doing this so long. This is what we are.
Yeah. Mean, that's what we sound like.
We're not like, you know, faking anything.
Well, since you've been doing it longer than Chad and Jeremy did it, and longer than the Beatles did it, and longer than all those other acts did it, they sound like you.
There you go.
There you go.
That's right.
Well, Steve has been in contact with Chad and Jeremy.
Yeah, Stuart, yeah. And I sent him One More Day, actually, and he said he liked it a lot. He said, God. I said, we tried to write a Chad and Jeremy tune, and he was very complimentary of it.
So we've always used Merseybeat, that sound, as our medium, like an artist uses watercolor or acrylic or something like that. That's just that's the paint we use.
But it's not just the beat. It's also the melodic lines that you use and the harmonies that you use and your vocal qualities, it seems to me. That all adds up to that sound. Is that just something that you fall into naturally?
We do. I mean, we're influenced by all those bands, and there was all this beautiful two-part Lennon and McCartney sort of things that we've, you know, spent our early days, you know, honing our skills and learning, you know, that's what they did, you know. So all the Beatles playing all those covers was a good education. Mm-hmm. And again, it's just kind of what naturally comes out.
The Beatles, I read this morning or yesterday morning, have sold more albums than any other act in the world ever.
Yeah, we haven't done that yet.
What is the popularity of that? Because they're multi-generational. It's not just the kids who were 12 or 13 or 14 in 1964 when they crossed the Atlantic. It's a new generation of people who still listen to that music. I mean, a lot of kids when I was 17 didn't listen to Frank Sinatra. They couldn't stand him. But kids today are listening to the Beatles.
They're good.
And therefore, by extraction, to you, they come to a concert by you. Maybe they don't know what you do, but they get there and they like it. What is the appeal?
I think it. I've wondered about that, and I've even analyzed it, and I can't really figure it out. It's just there's something magical about that combination of those four guys and their abilities and their connection to George Martin. And what he allowed them to do and what they allowed him to do to produce this body of work that is phenomenal. My daughter is 22. I think Catherine's 22. It's hard to remember now. But when she came up, her taste in music was a lot different. As she got older, into her teens, 15, 16, she was gravitated to the Beatles and that kind of stuff. And she is crazy about them now, whereas before she wouldn't listen to them. A lot of her friends did the same thing. Once they actually opened their minds up enough to listen to that music, they thought, my gosh, this is so much better than anything that we've ever listened to or that we thought was popular.
And yeah, because you can understand the words. The words mean something. There's a story being told. There's a melodic line. There's harmonies. You guys can sing. The Beatles.
Thank you.
You guys can play. So could they. And so much of today, I think, depends on electronics and what goes on in the studio, because you do it live as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's not just you're not just a studio band. Is part of the appeal for you guys, though, do you think, the fact that you do things that sound like an extension of that time, so that these could be songs from the missing Beatles catalog or songs that they would have done had they stayed together?
Yeah, we just sort of think of ourselves as a band that was around then, that wasn't around then, you know what I mean? Does that make any sense?
Sometimes, and a lot of stuff varies from that, but yeah, a lot of the times it is, you know, if you listen to our first album, record, LP, it does sound like a long-lost Beatle album, but we deliberately did that, but we've branched out since then. But still, the core of what we do, yes, it's... Mm-hmm. It's a sound.
There's a lot of other great kinds, you know, bands going on. I mean, there's a band called XTC that we listen to a lot, you know, that is, you know, they're just making wonderful music, you know.
Good pop music.
Rob says, it's all about the magic, and magic does come through, you know. I don't know. I believe in that kind of magic.
That's one of the Sponge Tones, Jamie Hoover, with us, with Steve Stokel and Rob Thorne and Pat Walters. They're going to be playing on September 25th at Dana Auditorium as part of Charlotte Pop Festival. They're also going to Tokyo, to Japan. We'll talk about that, hear more of their music when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is made possible in part today by the Pride Sunset Jazz Festival, headliner Marion Meadows, local and regional jazz ensembles, and a new multicultural career pavilion, September 19th, 1 to 10 p.m. at Symphony Park. CharlotteSunsetJazzFestival.com. Well, it's no secret that the American automobile industry is in pretty bad shape. We have two of the big three on life support. The third, Ford, said no to federal bailout money. They seemed pretty confident that they could make it without the aid, but they were also in favor of Chrysler and GM getting some money because the automobile industry in Detroit is really intertwined. We're going to talk to a Ford executive about American cars, how it all came to this, and what the future holds on this program tomorrow at 9.
World leaders struggle to bridge key differences in advance of December's UN Climate Change Summit in Copenhagen. Prospects for an international treaty to curb greenhouse gases, the Diane Rehm Show, Thursday.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, on listener-funded 90.7 FM WFAE, your NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're sitting here with the Sponge Tones, who are Jamie Hoover, Steve Stokel, Pat Walters, and Rob Thorne. And we're talking about their body of work and the fact that they're going to Japan to share this music with a whole different audience, I guess you'd say. And we've been talking a lot about this Beatles sound-alike thing, but not all of the things that you write and sing sound like the Beatles.
Started in times of the black and white, Fahrenheit 9 and propeller flight. I would kiss a girl and beg her to stay all day, whole night, but I held on tight to my solo flight. Propeller flights, it was me and the wind, and gonna get out of sight. Propeller.
Tell me about this song, Propeller Flights, from the Scrambled Egg CD, which came out a couple of months ago.
It's a song Pat and I wrote together.
Okay.
And Pat came up with a music bed and gave it to me. And I've been listening. I've been influenced by a guy named Bob Lind, who wrote Elusive Butterfly.
Yes, love.
I'm a big, big fan of his. I actually went out to LA.
I'm the only other guy who knows who he is.
Well, you know, a lot of people do know who he is, you know. But that folk singer approach is something I had always wanted to do. And again, Pat and I have done it a couple of times. We did it with a song called Home as well. But I just wanted to tell a story like that and do one of those things where you just use a couple of chords, go back and forth, and write a song about this, you know, this aviator out swinging, you know.
You know, Butterfly of Love, which was his song, his one-hit wonder, Bob Lind. I always loved that song, and people would tease me because I liked that song.
A friend here.
I think it is one of the best songs ever written. I mean, I had to cover it to mess it up a little bit myself so I could live with it.
Uh-huh.
And it's one of those songs that makes my stomach hurt when I hear it. You know, it's like the strings and stuff. It gets me every time. It never fails to get me.
Yeah, we went through a period where some of the stuff was very uncool, but there was something about it that if you really listened to it and you opened yourself up to it,
mm-hmm.
you could see the value of it. It was going against the grain.
Well, that was 67, and he did an amazing amount of stuff.
Yeah.
He's really worth checking out. He's,
okay.
And still sings like a lark.
Wow.
Still sings. He's, as a matter of fact, he's in the UK right now doing some dates.
So what is your process, your songwriting process? Because all of you, almost all of you, I think, do all four of you write? Or just
no,
three
I do not.
Okay. So the drummer doesn't talk, doesn't write.
but he plays darn good drum.
He is one really good metronome.
He locks it down with the
I haven't
the
I haven't been here long, so I'm trying to learn the language. I'm struggling with it, but I think I'm going to do okay.
I'll tell you, we write in different ways in response to your question. Sometimes one guy will just have, you know, it all come, the lyrics and the chords.
Right.
Sometimes, like Jamie described, I'll give him a piece of music, and in the case of Propeller Flights, the original demo that I had was really a dirge. Kind of was swampy sounding like the band or something that added with, I don't know, organs and whatever, people chanting in the background. But it had a melody and it had chords. And I said, hey, Jamie, what do you think about this thing? Can you do something with it? And so he came back with this folk piece, which I loved. And it's got kind of an irregular, I don't know if it's a regular meter, but irregular bar links and so on. So that was like a Dylan.
And those
kind
folk
of thing,
singer
really.
Guys would just, you know, whenever they would take a breath, they might go another half a bar or something. And that's the kind of stuff I was trying to incorporate in that particular song. Huh. You know,
Steve, you once said that in Dog Years, the Sponge Tones were 100 years old. And we have an email here from Bill and Matthews, who says, these guys are so talented in so many ways, I hope their presence graces the Charlotte music scene for another 30 years.
Aww,
that'd be another 100.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Bill.
We are holding on as long as we can. No, nobody gets out of here alive.
That's right.
The only way out is death.
And you were the guy, Jamie, I'm told, that pushed the band, told it to branch out, said we can do things other than sound like the Beatles.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, there's just, you know, the biggest thing is, especially in the case of us, because we weren't signed, we didn't have to follow any specific plan that some record label had for us. It's like, man, we can do whatever we want, and we're all over the map. I mean, Rob has this big band, you know, background. Rob's uncle was Les Brown, you know.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah, that's a
he
fact.
Was.
And Rob's dad played in Les Brown's band, so Rob's got all this history. Rob is old enough to have been around, you know, he was in a real rockabilly band at the time, uh-huh. sort of stuff. So Pat has a blues background, you know, a Cream sort mm-hmm. of background, you know. We all have these different things, and it's like, why not bring this all to the table, you know? Let's make the record for ourselves, and then if other people like it, that's good, you know. But you have to make it for yourself.
But your point is, Jamie was the one that pushed us to record and record original music rather than right. just playing Beatles songs, which that's is it. The way we started out.
Yeah. I want to play something, a portion of the title tune of last year's release. This is just a very cool piece of music, I think. It's called Too Clever by Half.
He was a logical boy, no room in his head for the things in the world he couldn't measure. A merry Andrew, they thought, put in a circus of plans that only he understood. He drew his pleasure. He juggles all the bits, and the ones that never fit he always drops. He examines all the fragments, only takes a nanosecond, and he cops the crux. He understands. He's so clever, very clever. He's too clever by half.
A little editing to put the Baroque piccolo trumpet in there earlier than it comes in the song, because it's so evocative of the Beatles.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Really?
But the yeah,
that's Doug Burns. That's Doug Burns, Doug by Burns the way, playing that piccolo. Yeah.
But hey, the Doug. Lyrics are just Too Clever by Half.
Well, the story is that, yeah, I had a title and a music bed, and I said it's called Jamie said it's called Too Clever by Half, and you have to open up a dictionary and pick one word off those two pages and use it in your line. And here's the first line: he was a magical boy, no room in his head for the blah, blah, blah. Tag, you're it. So he comes back with the next line: she was a blah, 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 blah. And that's by definition, I think that's Too Clever by
Gary
Half.
Andrew, yeah, the word I got. You
yeah,
know.
So I got a list of whose word was what, and that's the way the song came about. Is I thought, and one of my friends called that Ouija Bard.
Because I listened to it four or five times just today, and I thought, this is just, it's genius.
Well, thank you.
We went back and forth as long as we could playing uh-huh. that game, because it was a little intellectual exercise. It was fun.
It also seems to me to be something that works as a unit. I mean, the lyrics stand by themselves. The mm-hmm. tune stands by itself. But when you put it all together, it just all works together like a cross, like a puzzle. It just
yeah.
all interlocks.
That was our goal.
Well,
yeah.
Well, of course. But so many people try that, and it doesn't necessarily yeah. work out that way.
Yeah, we're especially proud of that one. Thank you.
Rolling Stone followed you for a while, and there was a guy at the Washington Post who reviewed you, who I happen to know. I can't think of his name now, but I met him like a long time ago, and he had some things nice things to say about you. And you mentioned that you're not widely released, but you have 12 albums.
Well, we just, by not widely released, mainly I just mean that we weren't on Capitol
right.
records.
Right. Well,
you know,
of course.
Our things were on independent, either our own label or small independent labels, except in Japan, where we have been on Sony for about 20 years, and now we're on airmail records there. But, you know, in the U.S., it's always been independent stuff. So the records have been around. Critics liked it. They've sold, you know, but it hasn't been like we had capital behind us.
Without capital behind you, how did you get on Sony in Japan?
They contacted, we were on a small label called Black Vinyl in out of Chicago, this band Shoes, basically, that were friends of ours that had a nice little label in place. And Sony contacted them and said, we like this stuff we're hearing from this band. Could you hook us up? And basically, Shoes, being the nice guys they were, just, you know, handed us over to Sony.
So how long have you been known in Japan, listened to, you know, played, bought in Japan?
We actually had one of our vinyl records was released on JVC Records.
That was early on, too, yeah.
Torn Apart was released in the 80s.
Yeah.
Over there. So, going back that far.
Mm-hmm. I have these two. I don't know whether these are posters for your show coming up, or whether, because it's all in Japanese.
they do interesting
probably
things.
Or whether
one of those is a promo, the other is they're giving to anybody that comes to those shows until they run out. They're giving them a little four-song EP of live stuff. So one of those is what that is, you know, promo for that, and the other is just SpongeTunes are going to be playing these clubs.
Well, this is radio, so people can't see what I'm holding up. Yeah. Let me describe what I'm holding up. This first one says, Meet the SpongeTones in the typeface and the layout of Meet the Beatles.
Yep.
Off their album. And there you are, guys, posed below in a pose that kind of looks like the Beatles. And then there's another one that's red that I'm not sure is evocative of the Beatles, but it's certainly evocative of album covers of that era where there's a big... It's a red album with a big gold seal on it that says Stereo 33. that takes you back.
High five.
Yeah, really.
High five. High fidelity.
Please, caution, do not play this with a monophonic needle. I'm going to play something else from Scrambled Eggs, which came out again last year, that reminded me first of the Monkees and Last Train to Clarksville, and then morphed into something altogether different. This is called Karma Depleted, which I kind of like the idea of.
So your karma's been depleted, you've invested too much time, and you've traveled around the country, but you didn't make a dime. Don't you know it's an impossibility? Well, you couldn't make the party, cause you thought it wasn't cool. Yeah, the last time that concerned me was when I was back in school. Then I got a lesson in reality. Can't be a greed. Don't ignore me.
And I said it kind of morphed into something else, and what I think it morphs into is you.
Good.
Yeah.
It's hard for us to be objective anymore.
Really?
Yeah.
Karma depleted. It kind of goes against your grain. You seem to have great karma. You keep going here, and you haven't run out yet. Where does the inspiration come from? How often do you sit down and write songs? Do they just come to you, and then you decide who you want to pair up with, or you do it yourself, or how does that happen?
You know, sometimes you write about real life things that are going on. Sometimes you write about things that are going on in other people's lives that you sort of fantasize or figure out. And sometimes you just pull stuff out of the air.
But many of the things that you write about, if you listen just as I did, if these were on vinyl, I would call it a needle drop. You can't do that on a CD, but... I listened to three CDs in the last several days and just kind of jumped around. A lot of the lyrics are very youthful, as though you were still 23 or 24.
We are.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good point.
Yeah. When you pick up the instrument and play music with this feel, it makes you feel young.
Which makes us feel it.
It keeps you young.
Yeah, it does.
Huh. The Japan thing, this fascinates me.
Because if you were Bruce Springsteen, I could get it, because they were, you know. But somehow they found you, and it just seems to me that if somebody in Japan likes an American group that is not necessarily nationwide in its popularity or renowned, that somebody would get a clue.
They do. They totally hope. They get it. I mean, they totally get it. I mean, they figured out Cheap Trick first, too. You know what I mean? A lot of people, you know, will have gotten their starts like that.
So have you played live there before? No. Will this be a new this will be a new experience.
Yes.
Do you have any idea what to expect when you get there?
You know, Shoes went over there. That band Shoes I keep referring to, but they went over there recently for the same label, and they just said they were treated like royalty. I mean, it's like they're very polite,
mm-hmm.
You know. So, and evidently the equipment that you get is the backline is great, and they just take care of
it. Where will you be playing? What kind of venues will you be in?
Just clubs, yeah. I'd love to say sheds, but no, clubs, which will be even
common,
better.
Yeah.
You know, they said that people were singing the lyrics, you know, that they knew the lyrics of their songs, and they were singing along with them on all the songs and all that. So we're hoping, you know, I mean, there's nothing better than that, you know, when you're playing someone to sing, you see them mouthing your words, you know, you wrote.
Yeah.
Instead of, you know, a cover.
That's pretty amazing. Wow. So when do you start preparing for that? Or do you prepare? Do you just go over there and sing like you've just done every, you know?
Yeah, we've been preparing for a year and a half at least.
Yeah.
No, we just keep running through the tunes and try to, you know, within the next month, we're going to really hone down the exact list. That we're
because you have a big catalog of music. I mean, you can't keep it all in your head, I would think.
We did 2 months of shows at a club in Charlotte where we played every Wednesday night, and that was for the sole purpose of just boning up on all these things we haven't played in a long time, you know, that we had to revisit.
We have an email here from Jules in Virginia.
Hey, Jules.
Yeah.
We know Jules.
Tell the boys Jules in Virginia says, hi, they're the best band in the world. My home office is a shrine to them. I own all of their CDs and albums. We've gone to see them live several times, driving 350 miles each way. So there's a real fan. We got Jamie Hoover here, Steve Stokel, Rob Thorne, Pat Walters, collectively known as the Sponge Tones, who have a song on their latest CD called Where You Gonna Go? And although it probably isn't about their musing about what's next in their careers, the lyrics do kind of work for that. And they're going to go play at the Charlotte Pop Festival on September 29th at Queen's University's Dana Auditorium. And then it is off to Japan at the end of October. Should I say sayonara? I mean, is that what you say?
Yeah, sukiyaki, all those good words.
Thanks for being here, guys. I appreciate your time and your music. And we're going to go out with Where You Gonna Go.
After you've used up all your tricks, after you've used up all your licks, after you've worn out all your picks, where you gonna go? After you've used up all your beats, after you've bruised your hands and feet, after you've worn out your drum seat, where you gonna go? Where you gonna go? Where are you gonna go? After you've smiled up all your faces, after you've closed down all those places, if you can't find an unfilled space, then where you gonna be? After you're all packed up and gone, after your hands and feet grew warm, after you've sung me up your song, where you gonna go? Where you gonna go? Where you gonna go?
And our program is made possible in part today by Charlotte Mecklenburg Stormwater Service. It's presenting the Big Sweep Annual Cleanup of Creeks and Lakes, Saturday, October 3rd from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Volunteer opportunities and information at stormwater.charmec.org. Coming up at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, world leaders are struggling to bridge key differences ahead of December's UN Climate Change Summit in Copenhagen. And Diane and her guests will talk about the prospects for an international treaty to curb greenhouse gases. That's all coming up in the first hour of the Diane Rehm Show, about 20 minutes from right now here on 90.7 WFAE.
I want to mention that I gave the wrong date out for the appearance at Dana Auditorium at Queen's University for the Sponge Tones. It's actually September the 25th. September the 25th. We're coming right back to talk about Ansel Adams and others.
With All Things Considered, you can turn your ride home into an escape, exploring a world beyond the headlines. All Things Considered finds stories you haven't heard, interesting perspectives, innovative ideas, and voices beyond the ordinary. Join us for something new and unexpected every afternoon. It's All Things Considered from NPR News.
Hear the full picture weekdays from 4 till 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
We're back on Charlotte Talks here on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. The Light Factory is opening an exhibit today here at Spirit Square featuring some of the photographs of the legendary Ansel Adams. But his work is on display with some of his colleagues from Group F64, specifically the work of Adams, Edward Weston, Imogen Cunningham, Willard Van Dyke, and Brett Weston. Collectively, they had a vision of photography that changed the medium and helped it become recognized as an art form. Dennis Keel is the chief curator of the Light Factory and a man who knows a considerable amount about these people and their contributions to photography, and he joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And some of the images in this exhibit come from the collection of the Bank of America. And so we've also invited Alan Blevins to join us. He is Bank of America's art director. Who knew they had an art director?
Thank you, Mike.
Welcome to the program. I've heard, and most of our listeners, of course, have heard of Ansel Adams, but probably not of Group F64. How did that group of photographers come together?
Well, they are all from California, at least the West Coast, and they came together with as a group because they were rebelling, and they were trying to create a new movement in photography, but they were rebelling against the popular photography at the time, which was a very soft focus, very painterly, very romantic type of photography, which was called pictorialism. Mm-hmm. And it was really a lot of the imagery was based on novels or stories, so it was very idealistic. And they felt, and also this was a time when, and actually it started at the turn of the century when everyone was trying to prove that photography was an art form, and a lot of photographers to do that created photographs that looked like everything but a photograph, but looked like it was being done anything but photography. It could look like a painting, could look like a print, could look like an etching, lithograph, or whatever. So, all the members of Group F64 got together because they thought they could create a piece of art, by also telling people that this is a photograph.
Mm. And isn't it ironic? It strikes me that when they decided we will use the camera to do what cameras do best, then it became an art form. As opposed to trying to make it look like a painting, they made it look like a photograph. It was crisp and clean. It used high contrast. They changed the kinds of the way they printed the photographs. And that's when it became an art
form. Well, right. And they were all these artists were influenced by the European modernism, which came in at the Armory Show in New York. And also analytical cubism with Matisse and Picasso and Braque. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of them were amazed by all of that. And again, they were thinking that, well, we can do all that. Let's try to do it with the camera. But we also want people to say, you know, that's a work of art, but it's also a photograph. So their idea was none of this soft focus, very kind of matte finish photography, but everything should be in very sharp focus. And mm-hmm. actually the name, Group F64, came from the smallest aperture opening on the large format camera, an example of which, just for your audience, we have an 8x10 camera right here, sitting right here. And so the smallest aperture gives the strongest depth of field and also the sharpest focus. And they also wanted to use, their subject matter was very different. Rather than sort of an idealistic subject matter, they looked at ordinary, everyday things and really kind of moved in closer and capture maybe possibly details of them and took something ordinary and, as I've often said, make them extraordinary, but also bring out the unseen beauty of these objects, like a pepper or an artichoke or something like that.
If you go through the exhibit, you see examples not only of what you're talking about right there, peppers and flowers, leaves and petals and pistils from flowers that look, if you look at them,
like the flower, but then when you first see them, you may not realize exactly what it is. It's just a form, which has been captured by the camera. But you also see an example at the very beginning of where photography came from. I think it's Edward Weston's work. At the very beginning, as you come in on the left, there are two or three shots on the wall that are different than everything else in the exhibit.
Well, a number of the members of Group F64 were pictorialists themselves. They started out in that manner, and then they, as they worked their way through it, and then they realized themselves, for a variety of reasons, they decided to change. And so we do have a couple platinum prints by Edward Weston. I have to say, at that particular period, although I think it's the earlier part, because Weston started out, he came to California, Glendale, actually it was called Tropico back then, Glendale, California, and from 1910 to, say, 1921, he had a very successful portrait studio where he did all pictorialist portraits. All of that has disappeared. He got rid of all of it because he put that part of his career behind him, and then he sort of looked forward. But there are some examples of platinum prints, in the show, which really are beautiful, and you can see his progression. He's moving towards a modernist look.
That's Dennis Keel, who's the chief curator of the Light Factory. Alan Blevins is also with us. He's the art director for Bank of America. And the bank's participation in this exhibit, which opens today at the Knight Gallery, is more than simply financial. Some of these images belong to the bank. And the bank has an extensive collection of artwork, from textiles to paintings, I'm assuming sculpture, and photography as well. How did the bank come to collect all of this?
Mike, it really reflects the history of the bank. If you look at how Bank of America's come to be, it's through a series of mergers and acquisitions of various banks. Each of those banks had art, which, you know, was a way that they supported the community, emerging artists. Most of these works were acquired early in the career of the artist. A lot of the works in our collections were acquired directly by the artist at the time. So, you know, if you go through the collection, and Dennis and I were talking about this, they all came, each of the pieces came from different banks that are now part of Bank of America. So there were some of these pieces came from the West Coast, from Security Pacific Bank in Los Angeles, or from Bank America in San Francisco. Others came out of Chicago, out of New York, Boston. So they all came from different regions of the country, and that's one of the reasons that makes the collection so unique and diverse, is just the breadth of the collection and the diversity of it.
So it's not just the fact that Hugh McCall, the former chairman, is an enamored of art himself, and is an art dealer and helped establish the art colony down here on the Tryon Street. It's that banks do this. Why do banks and Fortune 500 companies collect art? Why?
We do it for one reason. I mean, we feel, well, I wouldn't say it's really collect art, because we really are not in the market today to collect art. We support the arts is probably a better way to look at it, Mike. Is we support the arts because it's healthy for our communities. We feel really strongly that improving access to the arts, whether that's the visual arts or performing arts, is good business for the bank, because it's important to have strong cultural institutions.
So how did your participation in this come to be? Because how would the Light Factory know that you have a collection of Ansel Adams?
That's a good question. We launched a program last year called Arts in Our Community. And the purpose of the program is part of our overall broader arts platform, but it's a program where we make exhibitions available to museums at no cost. It's in an environment where particularly museums are struggling for funding. We already provide a lot of foundation support for the arts, sponsorship of exhibitions. This is another way that we can support museums, by making exhibitions available. Since launching the program, we've had 24 exhibitions across the United States. Next year, we'll be moving the program into Europe. In this particular scenario, Dennis is one of the top curators of photography in the country. It's very well recognized. And we were talking, and I had just done some research around the De Young Museum and an exhibition that they had in the early 1930s. And I knew we had a lot of works by these artists. And so Dennis and I were having lunch, and we started talking. I said, you know, I just find this fascinating how this small group of artists became so influential. And today, they are still recognized as icons of American art, but they all were a small, knit group that formed this group called L64 in Berkeley, California. And it started from there.
Ansel Adams is the most famous person in this group, I suppose.
Right.
How did he become, why did he become the most famous photographer, probably in the world?
Well, that's a good question, but I think his approach to early on, I think Ansel Adams became famous because he was not only a photographer, but he was also a writer, a technician, an educator. He was president of the Sierra Club for many years. He was a conservationist. So he was out there doing a lot of different things. But his approach to photography, I mean, there was a 19th century tradition when they went out west and they were documenting various landmarks. And, of course, when we think of Ansel Adams, we think of Yosemite. But he put a little different approach on his work, which appeals even to this day to the general public. And that is, his approach was, which was a little different from the sort of manifesto or the philosophy of Group F64, because, you know, when you talk about straight photography, you know, everything sharp focus, or pure photography, Ansel Adams took it one step further by photographing the landscape as he saw it, but also as he felt emotionally about it. So that meant making the sky darker than it really was, then that was okay with him. And as his career, you know, moved forward, he kept changing these prints, and you could see that progression. And they're really, they're just great, great images.
It's not just men in this group. And this was 1932.
32,
and
right.
There were women in this group, and one of them is on display. One of them has her work on display.
One of the best.
In this Imogen Cunningham, in this exhibit.
Right.
You told me yesterday that the men treated the women completely.
They were treated as peers. They respected their work. I mean, they were all. It was a real tough period because, especially in California at the time, because things got to California a little later. In New York, they had already dealt with this whole issue of pictorialism and, you know, straight photography. And so, Group F64 really, they saw the people in New York, and they were depending on who you read, they were competing with what they called the Photo Secession, Alfred Stieglitz's group, and they wanted the West Coast photographers to be recognized. And so they all got together and they were criticized heavily. So all of them, you know, from the media, from curators, Edward Weston, for instance, he was the internationally known at the time, and he had books, and he was, you know, everyone knew who he was. But he wouldn't send his work to any exhibition because he didn't want to be part of the pictorialist group. So they were under a lot of pressure at the time. So all the women and the men, you know, they just looked at their work and said, well, we're going to deal with this together. And Imogen Cunningham, there's a quote saying, I don't know how we stuck together because it was so difficult for photographers at that time, but we managed to all do it.
She became famous for her portraits of people like Martha Graham, the dancer, and Spencer Tracy and Cary Grant. Willard Van Dyke is also in this, and you were telling me yesterday that he was greatly affected by what he saw around him during the Great Depression and thought photography was a way to get that message out.
He was one of a few. He's the one who started the whole group F64. And even amongst the members, they all had the same focus, but their ideas of where photography should go differed. And Weston and Ansel Adams, you know, they were criticized because they weren't talking about the times or the industrial movement or the depression, but they felt, you know, art for art's sake. Willard Van Dyke was one, and there were a couple others in the group that felt that photography is a powerful tool for change. He actually later felt that it wasn't strong enough and moved to filmmaking, and for a number of years made a lot of films about what was happening, the condition of the country. And then he realized later, and I just throw this in, that he actually became the director of the film department at the Museum of Modern Art late in his career. But later on he came back and said that he was wrong because you know, every time a film is shown, there might be 100 people watching it, but then it's over, it's gone. But the still image, the photographic image, it seems to last much longer. You can see it all over the place. And
these images in the exhibit, the Group F64 exhibit, are powerful just as you look at them. And they're powerful as each individual unit. As a group, they're really powerful. I interrupted Alan in the middle of a thought a few minutes ago about the bank and why it's involved in this. I happened to watch a 4-minute video about the bank's involvement in the arts around the world. Kevin Spacey's in there, sitting in a chair at the old Vic, which he now runs in England, talking about Bank of America and how it helps support the old Vic. You're doing this all over the world.
We are. And it's part, as I mentioned, it's part of a broader platform around the arts. You know, I'm very proud to work for a company that understands that the arts is very important. As I said, we feel like it has a lot to do with the economic vitality of the communities in which we do business. And that's in the communities we do business is broader than just in the United States. You mentioned Kevin Spacey. We do have an emphasis on the visual arts, but it's much broader than that. Mm-hmm. For example, with Kevin, we're doing a project called the Bridge Project, which is a partnership between the old BIC and BAMP in New York. Where we are producing two plays in New York, and then they'll travel to OVIC and then travel throughout Europe, and it's all around exchanging cultures. And it's a cross between the company at the OVIC and members of the company at BAM. So that's just one example. Ken Burns' documentary, which is upcoming, is underwritten by Bank of America as part of our overall arts platform, the National Parks, which really ties really well in with this exhibition and also another exhibition that we have at the Bank of America Gallery.
The Group 64, I have to stop you because there's Group F64 and the Modernist Vision, photographs by Ansel Adams, Edward Weston, Imogen Cunningham, Willard Van Dyke, and Brett Weston will be on display beginning today through the 3rd of January at the Light Factory in the Knight Gallery here at Spirit Square.
And there is an opening reception tonight from 6 to 9. Everyone's invited, and they're going to see some great, great... I'll add.
You have to stop. Thanks for being here.